What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Gary Leland, the Bitcoin Boomer, Hall of Fame podcaster, BitBlock Boom, Crypto Cousins Podcast, 4MinuteCrypto.com, and so much more. There's a lot to cover here, even way before crypto, way before Bitcoin. Today you dropped 4Minute Bitcoin.com, which dropped with Bitcoiners have trillions of reasons to ignore elections. You know, without getting into left and right, you know, I watched the video. I think we agree. Without getting into left and right, though, because as Bitcoiners, I think that's a false dichotomy and we're kind of above that. But, you know, I think you've been through more election cycles than I have. What do you make of the current climate?
I've never seen anything like it. You know, I really don't talk politics. Never have, never will. Matter of fact, I block most people out of my feed who think for some reason they're making a post that's going to change my political views after 65 years of life. I usually just block them, and maybe if I like them a lot, maybe a few months after the election, I'll let them back in.
Yeah,
I'll give them one or two posts, but if I have someone who's just posting over and over, I don't care, and I don't care which side they're on.
Right.
I just don't want a feed full of it. But I've never seen, there's a lot of things I haven't seen before. I've never seen a climate where people didn't truly believe that everybody had the freedom to say whatever they wanted to say. And little things like, funny how the things come up in my feed on YouTube. How many videos there are for people, just as an example, stealing Trump signs. I would have never, ever thought about stealing anyone's sign out of their yard, because it doesn't hurt me for them to express their political belief. I wouldn't care if they were who they were supporting. I couldn't imagine that I would be so upset about it that I would think I would have the right to enter their yard. And I mean, and that's such a little thing, but it's an example of what we have going on right now, to me. And that is such a little thing, but I don't understand it. I don't understand a lot of this stuff going on. Yeah. And not that I need to. I mean, you know, but it's just, it's just kind of crazy that people, the way people act about politics. So my mom always said, you never get in arguments over games, religion, or politics. That's the way I was brought up.
Right.
And so pretty much I never have and probably never will.
Yeah.
But someone somewhere along the line, they quit telling people that. I mean, you know, I mean, because you see it after sporting events, they get in fights now. And, you know, that's just something they wouldn't have fun with. And
yeah.
Politics, they definitely get in fight with now. And I don't know if we see as many fights on religion as we used to. I mean, we used to see more of that in England, you know, Ireland and all that. So maybe we don't. Maybe it's not being covered as much and it's in other hotbeds. But maybe that's why she told me that. She knew what could happen. Because I'm sure a lot of this has happened before, but maybe not this extreme. You know, Woodrow Wilson, you know, he was wanting to, you know, do a lot of liberal stuff. Roosevelt wanted to pack the Supreme Court. So it's not like it's all the first rodeo for any of it. It just seems to be like it's on steroids.
Yeah.
I get.
Yeah. Did you ever follow, you know, the storylines? Maybe when you were younger, was it, you know, more, you know, maybe trendy, or not trendy might not be the word, but, you know, zeitgeist of the moment?
Well, I always voted. I voted every year since I could. You know, I protested in high school to be able to vote at 18. You know, that's the problem. Now that I'm not 18, that's the problem. They gave in to us. They should have never gave us the vote.
That's funny.
We didn't know what was going on.
Right.
Now I think you need to be like 28 to vote. I mean, you got to have some skin in the game of life.
I agree.
Before you decide how you want it to be handled by your government. But I was certain when I was 18 that we needed to have the vote at 18. All my friends were going to Vietnam.
Right.
You know, so if they were all going to Vietnam and getting killed, I mean, we certainly had a right to vote, but we had a right to drink then too at 18.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious where you were at 18. You know, from what I gather, you've been a serial entrepreneur your whole life. And so I'm kind of curious, how did that all come together? What were you doing? You know, where were you as a young man?
At 18, I was assistant manager at a clothing store at a mall. Malls were kind of a new thing then. So I was assistant manager at like a youth clothing store. It was called Bottoms Up, and it was like bell-bottom jeans and halter tops for girls and studded clothes and all the stuff hippies would wear. Because I was kind of a hippie back in those days, hair down to my middle of my back. I fit right in at that store. But I've always, since I was a kid, pretty much done a lot of entrepreneurship. I really didn't know that word until about 10 years ago, though. I'd been one all my life. I always tell people that because I think it's kind of funny. You know, when I was really young, at like maybe 10, I used to go out to the golf course on Saturday and Sunday mornings.
Is this in Texas?
No, this is in South Carolina.
Okay.
I grew up on an island in South Carolina outside of Charleston. But I would freeze cans of Coke. I remember that. And I guess we were so poor we couldn't afford a thermos. I'm not sure. I mean, a cooler. I'm not sure. But we would freeze cans of Coke overnight, and then I would take those frozen cans of Coke. I'd buy them by the case and out to the golf course, and I'd sell them to golfers on like the 16th hole because they were pretty hot by then.
Right.
And I'd sell them. I'd buy them at like a dime and sell them at like a quarter. And I did that for a few summers, you know, making money when I was a little kid. And then I did a lot of different ventures trying to get businesses started. I started Charleston Photography Company, where I would take pictures of tourists. Now, that sounds kind of weird. And if you were a tourist, you could get me to take your picture, and I'd mail you an 8x10 in the mail.
That's great.
Yeah, but you had to pay me, and trust me that I was going to send you the picture. But the funny thing about that is my first day I came up with this new venture, and I did it on a Saturday. I had a group of Girl Scouts come by, and they said, "We're getting ready to leave, and we have all this money left, and we thought we had to get you to take a picture and send it to all 27 of us." And so it was like more than I ever made any other day, and I made it like my first sale.
Right.
Yeah, so that was funny.
I'm really curious.
I've always done business.
Yeah, and I want to get into that because I think, you know, there's a lot of experiences there that I want to learn from. One thing that I'm curious about is what was the name of the island again?
James Island.
And maybe, you know, what was life like on the island? And I asked that as someone who also grew up on an island, but probably a very different island, much bigger one maybe. And so what was life on that? And how do you think that growing up on this island shaped your outlook on just, you know, being, you know, an islander?
I really enjoyed my life as a kid. It was a wooded island. When we came home as kids, we would just go straight into the woods and hang out till dark, you know, until our parents, it's time to eat. And then we'd go back out into the woods, and we walk out the backyard and go hunting, you know. And, you know, I have always said that if the end of the world came, I could just go live in the woods. I mean, I could survive, you know, because we did it as a kid. But besides my skills at that, it probably slowed me down a lot growing up on an island and becoming successful or going to the next level. You know, I've found in life that people who grow up on the beach or near beaches, especially in small town beaches, usually stay there at the beach and don't really get good jobs and don't really get real educated, has been my experience with it. Now you have a lot of tourists that come in and people who come from out of the area in, but people who grew up in those parts didn't seem to move along and focus, and they stayed there in houses that turned into crap houses that people paid tons of money for to tear down, you know, and build a nice house on. And that's the way we kind of grew up as kids, I guess. You know, I didn't go to college, you know, it wasn't even talked about. I mean, it wasn't even something that we said, "Hey, can we go?" Or "Can we get a scholarship?" Or, you know, "All my buddies are going." You know, so my wife has got her master's, but my kids got their master's, my son-in-law got their master's. So I believe in education. I just wasn't, I'm not saying it wasn't available to me, but I didn't see it as an opportunity. I went straight into the workforce. My dad was a manual laborer. My mom was a secretary. They wanted me to be a manual laborer out of the Naval Shipyard where he was a welder. My brother went to work out there. My brother-in-law went to work out there. My sister-in-law went to work out there. My sister went to work out there. Everybody I knew went to work out there. Like almost everybody on my street worked out there. In the morning at 7 o'clock, everybody got up and they got in their cars, four to a car, and they went to work out at the Naval Shipyard. And that's what my goal of my parents were for me was to go out there. They made me take 2 years of electric shop to be an electrician, because electricity was the future, not electronics, but electricity.
Right.
And which is a nice thing to have. I never had to pay to have a new ceiling fan put up or a light installed, fixture installed, or, you know, ever in my whole life. So I guess I've saved a ton of money, but that wasn't the route for me.
Right.
You know, I didn't want to do that for a living.
It's interesting. You know, I think I come from a little bit, you know, a different generation, younger generation. But for me, it was education that kind of got me off the island and got away from some of the people that never left. And that was the avenue. And I think the sort of the investment and the bet on college was different then, even, you know, because I'm a little older than it is now. But you used work to get off the island. You worked your way off
the island. I did. I had an opportunity to leave town, and I took the first opportunity I got.
Yeah.
I mean, I left immediately, first opportunity I got to leave.
Yeah. And so what was that opportunity? And
I worked for a cable TV company. Cable TV was brand new. And we were door-to-door salesmen with the cable TV company because I could always talk. I still can talk. That's my problem sometimes when people interview me. I talk too much. I should be kind of a good interviewer. You don't have to drag stuff out of me, I feel like. We would go door-to-door taking subscriptions for cable TV. And I got with that company in South Carolina, and I went to Miami, Florida, Dawson, Georgia, and we came out to Texas. Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. And when I came out here, oh my God, the whole newspaper, the help wanted section of the newspaper here was bigger than the whole newspaper back in South Carolina. So when we left, we're supposed to go next to Louisville, Kentucky. I said, I'm going to stay here.
Right.
I think I can find a job here pretty easy. And I went from that to storm windows, selling storm windows and doors.
Right.
And that was a heavy, high pressure closing job. I had never had a job. All my other jobs to then had pretty much been jobs as an order taker, you know, when it comes to sales, just taking orders. I didn't know there was a difference between an order taker and a closer. And that was a job where you definitely learned how to become a closer. And that was really invaluable training for the rest of my life.
What does that mean to you? How do you, like, what are some of the lessons of being a closer?
You know, well, do you know what a closer is? I don't know how educated you are on the subject.
I'm going to say no.
Okay, well, a closer, basically, you come in and the whole time you're there, you're not only selling, which you're always selling yourself, but you're closing doors so that people can't say no because they've already said that's not an option before they even knew that you were going to be asking them something and that would be the option for. You know, so like, for instance, you would say something. Since we were selling energy-saving products, you know, in conversation, you kind of go, wow, what do you think? Electricity was going up at a fantastic rate in the 80s, early 80s. You'd say something like, wow, what do you think electrical rates are going to do in the next 5 years? Double, triple, quadruple? And they'd always go with triple because it was in the middle.
Right.
And what you've done at that point, you just got your ammunition you're going to use 3 hours later. Let me see how much is your electric bill? You say it's going to triple in 3 years, So in 5 years, your electric bill is going to be da-da-da-da-da. So you got that bullet. You close that door. And then you might show the patent that the company has. And you said, would you really want to buy storm windows from someone who didn't have this patent? And they go, no, of course you wouldn't.
Right.
And so now they can't say, I'm going to buy from someone else because they just told you they wouldn't buy from anyone who doesn't have that patent and no one has that patent because it's your patent. So you're closing all these doors. So when it gets time to, and do you need someone else here to make this to find out about this in case you wanted to make a decision? No, I can make all the decisions. But now they can't say, I need to talk to my neighbor or I always talk to my daughter about this because they told you that they can make a decision. And you get all these bullets. You close all these doors as being a closer. And then when you get ready to start closing on them or making the sale, in an average sale for this product, it's like a siding sale, probably. I never sold siding, but it's like a 3-hour pitch. And by the time you get to that point, they go, well, that's a great product. And that price looks really good, but I can't buy today because I have to talk to Susie. She helps me with all my decisions. I said, wait a second. You told me when I got here, you could make the decisions. Were you lying to me? You wouldn't say lying, but you put it in that way. And they go, no, I can make the decision. but I think I should get a price from someone else. Well, you can't get this anywhere else. You told me you wouldn't want Stormwind as it didn't. So you're closing doors. That's what being a closer is. And I was always an order taker. And that's what you have. You have order takers and you have closers, and they're both salespeople. But one is just taking the order. Do you want a pair of pants in the store? And they go, yeah, so let me take your order.
How and when do you think you leveled up? And it seems to me you probably learned this from maybe watching others, which I'm not sure everyone can maybe pick this up and distill it the way you have.
Well, it was training that the companies that do that, whether it's storm windows, whether it's sightings, whether it's magazines, whether it's Bibles, I mean, they all are very hardcore training, and they have every day we would go to at this particular company, we'd go in for half an hour to 45 minutes of training. Even if you'd been there 2 years, you were there.
Right.
That was their deal. All the salesmen showed up, 45 minutes, going over sales, top closer of the day, one salesperson, top closer of the week. You know, all the numbers are on the board, a closing tip, practice closes, you know, close off competitions, you know, so right. You're constantly learning how to close. It was an invaluable training to me for the rest of my life. And now I really don't have to do any closing nowadays, but it makes it so much easier to recognize when you're being closed is when it comes up more for me. Cause I'll say to someone, I'll say, hey, they'll start trying to close me and they'll laugh because they know that I know,
right?
You know, the inside scoop, you know? So, but it's a big difference between a salesman and a closer.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. When did you start the wallpaper store?
We started that in 81. And that started as a mini blind company, actually. Back then, there were so many houses being built that you could go to a brand new neighborhood and just walk down the street. And you could see houses with sheets on their windows instead of blinds or draperies. And you knew those people just moved in their homes.
Right.
And they didn't have blinds. So that's a good prospect. Brand new house, no blinds. And you just go up to them and say, hey, I'm Gary. I sell mini blinds. You need any? They go, yes, I do. Come give me a price. And they would buy from you right then on the spot. And they'd be so happy you came. And they'd be going, thank you for coming and taking my money. I had no idea what I was going to do because even Home Depot didn't have them at the time. And we were doing so well that I quit my full-time job and started doing it. My wife and I started on weekends. We were renting limos. We were young kids renting limos to go party at night, going to Europe. I mean, we thought it would never end. I mean, we really thought we had the cash cow business.
Right.
And we probably sold more mini blinds in Texas at one point than anybody else. People from China were coming to see me to get my business, wanting us to buy container loads, and it, you know, finally died. The business died. But in the meantime, I realized that wallpaper was a really good business, and I started incorporating that into my blind business. So when the blind business died, we were in the wallpaper business, and we grew that business because, you know, mini blind business is not only is it a dead business, but you're salespeople. You teach them how to become good salespeople, which I was good at in-home sales and closing. So I taught them, you know, everything they need to know, and then a few years later, they'd go buy $100 worth of samples and start their own company. Why right. should they let me get half their money? But wallpaper was a little different. So I wanted to get out of the blinds and get into wallpaper because, you know, every one of those wallpaper books costs $100. You know, when you come out of my wallpaper store, you know, I've got maybe 200-400 wallpaper books at least. Maybe I used to have 1,000 probably at one time. There's just not as many. But when you're paying $100 a piece, it's quite an investment. And no one's just going to open up one of those tomorrow, you know, and compete against you. And that's been a very good business for us. Like I said, since we probably got into wallpaper in 86. So it's been a very good business for us.
Wow. And when did e-commerce come into, you know, sort of your entrepreneurial pursuits? It seems like you just take on whatever comes your way. It's very organic.
Yeah, I do. I change a lot with the times. I started e-commerce. I tried. My first attempt was in 95. But I couldn't figure out the shopping cart. I couldn't get that done. And so maybe it was even early 95, I guess, is when it was. I'm going to say that's when it was. I even let my domain name go back because I gave up on it. I said, I can't get this stuff to work out. So then in 96, I went and bought my domain name again because they were like $175 back then. And no one wanted Leland's wallpaper. I mean, you know, it wasn't even hardly a business. So I bought it again and got it up to this time I got it up in 96 and I started, and I think we were like the first wallpaper store on the internet. People, I called all my vendors asking if they had photos of the wallpaper patterns that I could use. And they all said, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. We're not going to waste our time sending it to you because that's stupid. No one's going to buy wallpaper on the internet. And I said, well, I'd buy wallpaper on the internet. Right. And so now a lot of people buy wallpaper on the internet.
If you back it up a little bit, I mean, are you messing around with computers since the 80s? Are you on the internet before this? What made you, I mean, well, obviously
I
you're
I bought my first computer in 83. I bought the original Mac that came out. The first Macs that came out. I think you might be able to see it in the corner of the room over there. I still have it right behind me over my shoulder. I don't know if it shows up in the screen. But I went into a computer store. I knew nothing about computers. Said, hey, I need to buy a computer. And I saw a friend of mine who was kind of a geeky guy. I thought maybe he knew more than I. He's getting this compact with two disk drives in it and stuff. I said, I guess I'll take whatever he's getting. And he goes, do you know DOS? And I didn't even know what DOS was. And I said, no, I don't. And he goes, well, you're going to have to, that's a computer language you're going to have to learn, or you can buy this new computer we just got. It's point and click. And he showed it to me and said, well, hell, I'll take this. You know, this looks great to me. So I took that and started using that. And I'm still not a great coder. I mean, you know, I can muddle my way through stuff, but I always have had people I've hired to do that for me. You know, it's like I'm not real good at, I'm not trying to blow coders by any means, but I'm not good at washing my windows in my store either. You know, so I pay someone to do that. Right, I pay someone to do a lot of things, you know, sure. And coding is one I've never had to learn. I've been able to pay people to do. And I usually get kids going to college, you know, to do it for me. They need a job. There's a college down the street. And I'll get them for like 4 years or so. And they'll have a friend. So I'll constantly have people going through that know how to do what I need done.
Right.
Yeah. And some of them know how to do way more than I need done.
Yeah. And then when does podcasting come into it? I mean, you're one of the first 50 or 100 podcasters in the world.
You know, 2004. I had a kid that was a really bright kid. He was going to UT, University of Texas, and he came home for Christmas and he called me and said, hey, can I work for you during Christmas? Because he'd worked for me during high school. And he was a real bright kid. I still use some of the things he wrote for me. And that was in 2004. And I said, sure. I said, you know, I saw this thing called podcasting. I'm not really familiar with it, but let's get that going. Because I read a paragraph about it on an email I got that there's this new thing coming out that might be good for marketing called podcasting. So we started recording some podcasting in like the next week. And by the time his holiday was over and he's ready to go back to school, not only had we started podcasting, but he had built an entire podcast directory. And we were one of the first podcast directories on the internet before Apple came out with the podcast.
Sure.
So if you wanted to find a podcast, you'd come to my site and search there for podcasts. Right. I remember when we got our 50th podcast, I remember telling my wife, oh my gosh, there are 50 podcasts now. Can you believe it? There are 50 of these things.
50 now, is this 50 different episodes or 50 different shows 50 you're running?
Shows.
50 shows.
50
and how many are
50
you,
shows that were on then?
Yeah, yeah. And how many are
on my site?
Right. How many are you hosting? Because I mean
at that time I was hosting one.
Okay. And then when does this, I mean, Fast Pitch Academy and a lot of different
Yeah.
And then I guess that's.
I've had a lot of podcasts.
Yeah. And
I find it to be a great marketing mechanism.
Right. And I think this stems probably from a lot. I mean, I think you have a sporting goods store.
Yeah. Softball, baseball store.
Okay. And,
so a lot of my podcasts over the last 10 years have been stick and ball related. I've had the Fast Pitch TV show. I've had the Fast Pitch chat show, the softball cheer show. I mean, a lot of the softball equipment review show.
And does this come out of maybe, I'm just guessing here, is this because your kids are playing sports or what sports?
Well, softball started because my kids played sports and we couldn't find softball equipment. And since I had built a website before, I said, well, I'll build a website and I can buy this stuff wholesale from the manufacturers. Funny, when we first started doing that, you'd check out and you'd go to Leland's wallpaper shopping cart because I was so lazy. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to build a shopping cart because you couldn't buy shopping carts like that back. You can now. And, you know, we started doing that and I had like maybe three kids working for me, maybe four in the store working on the wallpaper sites. And I was doing that home in the evening. And I looked 1 month and we did like $5,000. I was like, oh my gosh, we did $5,000 in softball sales. I said, everybody quit working on wallpaper for a while. We're all going to just work on sporting goods. And the next month we did 10,000, next month 20, next month 40, next month 80, next month 100. I mean, it grew exponentially like that. Because we were the only fast pitch softball website on the planet. I mean, everywhere else you had to go was either a men's slow pitch website are a baseball site, and we sold girls fast pitch softball equipment, and we're the first one. We invented, we were the first ones to start using pink softball equipment. And oh my gosh, nobody did that. And it was like, we had the whole market for the whole world. I was ordering custom from like Louisville Slugger, hundreds of backpacks that were black and pink, you know, for girls to carry their baseball, softball bats in. Mizuno Sporting Goods came to me and said, hey, we want to do a pink cleat. Would you buy our first batch of pink cleats that we come out with? I said, sure. And so, because it was my deal. And pink is good if you're the only person in the country selling it. But there's not enough girls wanting pink softball equipment when everybody can sell it.
Right.
But when you're the only one selling it, man, it's a good damn business.
Yeah.
So I was talking to an Olympian, Lisa Fernandez, probably the greatest softball player of all time. So I said, hey, have you ever been to my website? And she said, what's the name of it? And I said, Softball Junkie. She goes, is that the website with the pink softball glove? I mean, that's how rare it was.
Right.
This Olympian even knew my website because it had a pink softball glove on it. And I said, well, yes, it is. You know, I'd have those custom made in there. And so, but in my kids, I started it because we couldn't get softball equipment. I never planned on it. I was planning on using it more as like a fake thing that we would say, yeah, we are store, sell us some equipment at cheap and let us buy. Because we were buying, like, in the fall, we had to buy football cleats 1 year for her to play ball in. Yeah, because you couldn't get them. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't get baseball or softball because it wasn't season. And she played year round at a very high level. Like, we won 2 state championships in Texas, 14 under and 15 under. So we were, I guess, somewhat of an adequate team.
Yeah. You know, it seems like you follow your interests, and, you know, it seems like you're a problem solver. You kind of see where the needs are. You're not afraid to go down sort of like niche areas to see where people want help. What do you think your superpower is?
I think I have 2 superpowers. I know I have 2 superpowers. My first superpower is one that would have been good if I was a carpenter or if I was a home builder. Right? My great-grandfather was a home builder. My grandfather was, and my dad grew up as one, but he became a welder. I can take a piece of wood 4 foot wide and a saw, and without marking it, I can cut it in half and be within 1/8 of an inch over and over again. Now, that's not a very good skill for me to have, but with the way I build stuff, it's okay. But if I was a carpenter, man, that'd be a handy tool to have. I mean, I can look at windows, tell you the size, 6'5" 4". I mean, I'm really good at size and dimension for some reason. That's one of my superpowers. But my other superpower, which is the superpower I've made a living off of, is I'm capable of seeing things like the average Joe. I think that's my superpower. I can see things and see how the average Joe would look at it and say, hey, we need to tweak this because the average person's not going to be able to figure this out. And that came real handy when we were designing websites to begin with. I'd look at the work one of my guys had done. We were building a new site because we run lots of websites that sell the same thing, most of them. And I'd look at the site and I said, how in the hell do you check out in this site? I can't even find it. And I'm the one who's responsible for this. And they go, well, if they can't figure it out, they shouldn't be shopping on our website. You know, so, I mean, I just have always thought that was my specialty, though, is looking at things as an average Joe would look at things.
Right.
Not just the net, but life in general, my stores, everything, you know, and so that's my real superpower. But the cutting wood in half's another good superpower. If you're a carpenter, it would be a great superpower.
Right. It seems, you know, obviously you're happily married, you're a successful entrepreneur. What advice, you seem incredibly happy. What advice would you give to young people?
Well, I think people were too quick to change, you know, whether it's too quick to not be single anymore and get married, or whether it's too quick to like get married and then want to check out some other woman, or whether it's too quick to get married and want to divorce, or too quick to change jobs, or I think you need to slow it down and check out what you're doing, but not be afraid to make a move, but don't jump into the move right away. But don't be afraid to make a move. I mean, I've been told, I don't know how many times I've been told that something I wanted to do was stupid and it, you know, made a good living for me, you know, and some of them were stupid. But I made more positive inflow of money from the stupid ones that worked than I lost on the stupid ones that didn't work.
Right.
You know, so I just think it's like, I don't know. It just seems like so many people, and I was, you know, It's just weird, and I hate to say that because my parents used to say that, but now I understand why. It's just so many things have changed over 40, 50 years. It's just amazing, you know. I knew no one on my whole street, you know, that got a divorce when I was a kid. Now you can't go down the street without half the population getting a divorce, and a lot of them with young kids, you know, and that really does affect the kids. I don't care what you say, you know. Kid gets a dad on the weekend, you know, or something like that. And, you know, the mom saying bad things about the dad and the dad saying bad things about the mom. And it's just bad for kids as a whole. And then they grow up and they're a little messed up, maybe. Not really, but subconsciously there's some fixing to be done because they've heard all that growing up, all that bad talk. And I'm just talking. I might be wrong. Sure. This may not ever happen, but it's just what I'm guessing, you know. But so many things have changed and some for the good. You know, because I remember when I was a little kid, we were at the laundromat. We didn't have a washing machine at the house for clothes. And I wanted to go to the bathroom, and the bathroom was broken, closed for repairs. But there was another bathroom, and I couldn't use it because it was the black bathroom. You know, my mom wouldn't let me use it. And I was going, I got to go to the bathroom pretty damn bad. So I couldn't use it. So like I said, a lot of things have improved for the better. So I'm not saying the good old days were the good old days. I'm just saying there are a lot of things that were good that I don't think we needed to get rid of, you know.
How much of that you think is related to the money? Terms of monetary policy and maybe, you know, you know, fiat and going off of gold.
Well, it certainly has increased since we went off of gold, you know, and we went off of, I've never put that connection together. But there certainly should be room to have that discussion as to what fiat has done to us since we went off the gold standard. You know, I posted the other day, you know, Isaac Newton invented the gold standard and Nixon took us off. You know, one was a genius and one was an idiot, you know. So a lot of other things have probably happened, too, besides that, by being off of fiat.
Sure.
Yeah, and you're right. I don't know. I think there's always been a lot of opportunities to screw around on your spouse or to, you know, break away. I don't know if fiat really had a lot to do with that. That's a good conversation to have, but I think that could be a whole conversation.
Sure, I understand.
Yeah.
You know, you seem to have a voracious appetite and to explore take on new things. You know, at the same time, you know, it seems like you're never going to stop. What brought you to Bitcoin, though? And, you know, how did you find it? Maybe what tickled your fancy about it right away? Or was it not right away? I'm not sure.
Hey, and before we get into that, if on my last statement about family marriages and kids being affected, if I offended anyone, that certainly wasn't my goal. I'm just looking at everything from a different view than a lot of other people are because we're on opposite sides of the timeline. So because I never want to hurt anyone's feelings.
I hope no one, I didn't think it was an offensive or any.
Well, you never can tell how people will take something sometimes. Sure. So I just throw that disclaimer. But on the other subject, I found out about Bitcoin when it was $100, a friend of mine locally, but it was represented to me as online stock. I think he said something like, well, it's kind of like online stock. And I wasn't interested in that at all, you know, getting into online stocks. And then later I heard about it when another friend of mine, Adam Curry, he was like, I haven't been in podcasting, I listened to his show since it started. He was talking about someone gave him 33 Bitcoins as a tip and that they were worth like $1,000. And I said, wow, that's getting interesting. Because I think the last time it was $100. And then it passed by. And then I was speaking at a conference in Dallas and I was going down a hallway and a friend of mine was there telling four other people about Bitcoin. And I came in on the end of the conversation. And they left. They weren't interested, I guess. So I stayed and talked to them. And it must have been about 1 o'clock. And we went down and sat on the couch and talked about Bitcoin until the convention was over that day. Mm-hmm. And then I went home. The way home, you know, since I'm really big in podcasts, I found a podcast, some podcasts about Bitcoin, and listened to them on the way home that night. Came back the next day. We went over to his house. He has some mining rigs going. And we talked to Bitcoin the entire day again. And I think the next day I went to Coinbase and started buying Bitcoin.
Right.
You know? So once it's kind of like, I think Bitcoin's hard to see, but once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's hard because for me, it was hard to understand. But once I got it, I mean, it's impossible ever not get it.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's kind of like a religion. I decided that the other day. I have a friend of mine who became a Jehovah's Witness. And he goes up and down the street. He does, literally, at 65. He puts on his white shirt and goes up and down the street with his wife door to door. They have a route they go to cover the whole island, which is big now. You know, tons of condos and stuff to spread the word. Because that's his mission in life. And he feels he's doing everyone a favor by trying to save them and convert them. He's doing them a favor. You know, he's you know, maybe he also think he's going to get a little more grace with God for spreading the word. But I think truly he feels deep down inside that he is like doing these people a tremendous favor by telling them about God and Jehovah's Witnesses. And that's kind of like Bitcoin is, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You like you believe so much in it and what it represents and what it's going to do to the future just over the history that you're wanting to tell everyone about it, not because you're going to get any more Bitcoin, but because you don't want them to miss out.
Right.
And you want to share this good word with them and say, hey, you know, I'm going on the Bitcoin gravy train. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to be there. I'm already prepared. Just like he's saying, I'm going to heaven. I'm already prepared, but I want you to come. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, and I want you to come with me too and have these riches on earth that Bitcoin's going to give us, you know? So to me, it's kind of the same effect on a person that a religion has on a person. And I don't know, maybe I've seen that somewhere before, but the other day I was talking to my friend and it dawned on me, you know, I was going, oh my gosh, I'm selling you on my religion.
Right.
You know, just like you try to sell people on your religion.
Yeah.
Not that Bitcoin's my religion. I'm Catholic, but you know.
Fair enough. How long do you think it took you from interest, you know, buying on Coinbase to religious? And maybe what was some of, you know, some of the key, you know, revelations along the way? You know, I think, I don't know if it was all at once or maybe there was a few nuggets you kind of helped you along the way.
Well, I started buying Bitcoin in maybe around August of 2017. It was around $3,500. And I was just buying it. And I think like many people, I felt like at the time, if Bitcoin could go from a point in time from 50 cents to, well, we got up to 19,000, what could something else do? You know, so I started buying some shit coins too.
Sure.
You know, thinking, and I think that's kind of natural for mm-hmm. people to do that. They don't understand it well enough and they want to like, they figure something else can do it too. They really don't understand.
Yeah. And I think then, the way they're positioned on the websites as well, like Coinbase, they're positioned alongside. And you think about traditional investing, which I don't think is necessarily mm-hmm. good advice, but you want to diversify. And I don't think that's, and this is not an investment show.
I agree with you 100%.
You know, most people who make wealth don't diversify until they've already accumulated wealth. But yeah, so I didn't mean to interrupt.
Sorry if I was interrupting you, but yeah, I agree with you 100%. But I did that, and then I started a podcast, BitBlock Boom, a Bitcoin conference. And I started that in 2018, I guess. I mean, it hadn't even been a year. And at that time, I still was kind of a crypto person, I guess. You know, but I'd say somewhere between the 2018 event and the 2019 event, I finally understood it. Mm-hmm. You know, that Bitcoin was the deal.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but how much of that do you think was from maybe the reaction you got from Bitcoiners at 2018 kind of maybe drove some of that revelation for you, I wonder?
I think it had a little bit to do with that. The people that I met, because it was never originally intended to come off as a Bitcoin maximalist conference, but everybody that agreed to speak was a Bitcoin maximalist.
Right.
So it was a Bitcoin maximalist conference, but that wasn't the goal. And the people I met started hanging around and started seeing talk. I started hearing more about Bitcoin from different levels. And then went out to California to Bitcoin 2019. And the people I knew already were all Bitcoiners, and they introduced me to other Bitcoiners. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of in that group or around that group of people that only talked about Bitcoin. And so I started understanding more and more and more and more. And then by the time, you know, BitBlock Boom 2019 came, you know, I completely understood. I completely was a Bitcoin maximalist.
Right.
I completely felt like I understood why everything else was a shit coin. And I mean, I have some bags somewhere, but it's like, I think I have $35 worth of some crap somewhere and $40 worth of some crap somewhere. It's not even worth the, I don't even know if I can even take them off the exchange. You know,
right.
They're such small bags of crap. So,
it's interesting. I don't know when I first heard of the conference, but I know I heard of it definitely before 2019. I probably heard it in 2018, but for me at that point, I'm class of 2017. I came in October when I seriously first started to really look at it. Went through, you know, kind of the diversification shitcoin rabbit hole as well a little bit. But it wasn't really, you know, at first it was hard to find to figure out which conference was legit, which one was a Bitcoin conference. You know, to even part with my Bitcoin for a conference or part with fiat that I could spend on Bitcoin or convert to Bitcoin. And then, but really in 2019, right away, it was one of the most organic things I've ever seen in the space. Michael Goldstein's talk leaked. And it was, you know, and it was the art of Bitcoin rhetoric, how to meme Bitcoin to the moon. And it was, for me, it was one of those revelatory moments about Bitcoin, not in terms of conviction, but in terms of, you know, where we can fit into the space, how we can contribute. But also that Twitter was this battle space. And,
right.
You know, it was where I learned about, or what I think I started to understand what the plebs do, or the plebs, where they just, you know, they battle it out with all these ideas. And so I was really disappointed to miss that conference. 2020 was another strange year.
Yes, it was. It was a strange conference to put on. That was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life was getting that conference.
I'm so proud of you for doing it. Proud is not the right word. I'm you know, happy, excited that you did it. I wish I was there. You know, it took place. It was tough. I got young kids, so it's hard to get away. And this year was just a little bit more tenuous to travel and things like that to be mm-hmm. away from my family. But again, I really felt they missed out.
I
wanted to go. And I've already booked my tickets for next year.
Oh, yeah, I saw that the other day. Thank you. That conference, this year's conference, well, actually, Michael's talk that you mentioned kind of put us on the map because mm-hmm. that thing went viral, you know, at 2019. Now, 2020, I had so many things happen, you know, that were like last minute. I think 3 weeks before the conference, my hotel shut down for COVID. I mean, so not only did I have everything else happen, when she called me, I was going, is there anything else that can possibly go wrong?
Right.
You know, so my hotel even shut down. I had 3 weeks to find a new hotel and conference center. But, you know, what I was going to say is I had so many people canceling because of COVID. Like I lost all my international audience, and I usually have more people from Europe mm-hmm. than I have from Texas.
Oh, wow.
So I lost all of them. And I lost a lot of people who couldn't come. But as it got closer to the date, it started growing like crazy, the people signing up to come. I mean, it was just mind-boggling how many people the last month mm-hmm. signed up, because I think they were all like going, oh my gosh, there is a Bitcoin conference right. somewhere that's
it's
in real life.
Happen.
And I got all these people where at first I thought COVID was hurting me. COVID actually helped BitBlock mm-hmm. boom.
Made it stand out.
Because now all these people came that never would have come. And they said, oh my gosh, this is a great conference. And all the people that canceled because they couldn't come because they were out of the country or their wife wouldn't let them come or whatever reason. You know, so I'm not giving a hard time for the reasons. That's what I'm saying. They just couldn't come. They already knew what it was. So they're going to come back next week as well as the people who came because it was the only one to go to. So when you look back in the future, when we look back at BitBlock Boom, I think we'll say, my gosh, COVID was the best thing that ever happened to BitBlock Boom. You know, because those mm-hmm. people know if I can do a conference that good of a conference during COVID,
right?
What would it be like, you know, when I have all your point? We're already sold 30% of the tickets.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to sell out probably in the next couple months.
I mean,
you know, and it's not till next August.
And you know, tomorrow night you're doing the barbecue, the monthly barbecue.
That's brand new.
I'm jealous.
Barbecue.
That sounds really exciting. I love barbecue. I love Bitcoin. I'd love to see Bitcoiners in real life.
Well, you know, I've been wanting something to go to besides once a year, and no one's doing anything. So it's just a big meetup is all it is. I mean, I'm not making any money off of the BitBlock barbecue. You know, I'm just like finally got together and I had enough email addresses you know, from BitBlock Boom, that I could put those all in, the Evite, you know, all the ones that are from Texas, Oklahoma, you know, anywhere close, and just put them on the Evite. And I think maybe we've got 25 people or something coming to the
first one.
But I've been wanting to do something, and no one's doing anything. So I said, heck, I'm just going to set it up and do it. So,
you're a doer. I'm curious, do you think the conversation, you know, I'm assuming you're around your kids a bit. Is the conversation around money changing in their generation? Do you hear things? Do you see anything?
My kids are very successful. So we trained them really well with money and how to make money and how to work, and gave them all the tools they needed. They got out of college with no debt. And, you know, they had jobs the day they got out of college. And they are very successful. We really don't talk about money much, except they'll kind of brag to us how much they have, you know, which makes us happy, you know, because they're doing really well in life. So they have no negativity toward money. One of them has some Bitcoin. She thought she'd go ahead and buy some. And the other one doesn't believe in Bitcoin, you know. So she goes, I don't know about all that stuff. It sounds like it made up internet money to me. And I'm like, hey, that's fine. You know, you can decide on it whenever you want to decide.
Right.
I'm heavily into Bitcoin. I believe in Bitcoin quite a bit. So I have quite a large amount of my capital in Bitcoin. I don't think you can ever go wrong with Bitcoin.
Right.
You know?
What do you
I can tell you about the money, how they feel about money, because they're both successful and they have some.
Right.
You know,
right.
That point is whether you have some or not is how you feel about money.
Yeah. Yeah. What about your Bitcoin, you know, normie boomer friends? Or I'm sorry, not your Bitcoin, your normie boomer friends that are not into Bitcoin, or is the conversation changing?
Well, you know, that's also hard to say because of COVID. Mm-hmm. You know, boomer friends are the ones that scared they're dying, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm one of the few boomers who's running around not real worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm kind of like going, I wish I kind of get it over with, is what I was saying before.
Wow. Okay.
Because I'm like, I'm not heavily overweight. I walk 2 miles a day. I don't take any prescriptions. I don't have anything wrong with me at all. I think it would have been a bad case of flu. I don't want to have the flu either, but I don't feel like I would have died from it, which I might have. Who knows?
Right.
If you died, you're dead, so you're not going to feel bad anyway. So I was kind of, but my friends don't do anything. Mm-hmm. They don't, literally, I don't do anything. But before COVID, let's go back then. Before COVID, they were starting to ask me finally, because I'm the guy who's known for the Bitcoin guy. You know, like at the Super Bowl, friend of mine rented a movie theater to watch the Super Bowl and had him bring an open bar. This is a great place to watch the Super Bowl, you know? And so we're watching the Super Bowl and this chair gets sitting beside me. This guy comes over. I know him. He goes, hey, I've been wanting to talk to you about Bitcoin. Can we talk about Bitcoin? I'm like, yeah, I love talking about Bitcoin, but gosh, you know, we are watching the Super Bowl in a movie theater, you know, with an open bar. I mean, this is a pretty good time.
Mm-hmm.
This is so, you know, I was starting to get questions from people about Bitcoin events I'd go to, you know? And I got a friend, my best friend, I finally got him to start doing Swan. So he's buying now daily cost averaging Swan. My sister, she's 70. She just started buying with Swan. So they see me posting so much, I think, that they're saying, hey, how do I get into this? It's just that I don't see a lot of people my age, you know, like I used to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like they're all having parties or something right now.
Yeah.
You know, so the COVID has affected my...
Do you guys have a conversation around, I mean, are they upset with you for being active? Do they think you're being...
I don't see them. I don't know. I don't see them.
Okay.
I don't see them. I don't have any idea.
Got it. You know,
I literally don't see them. Like, one of our friends have not been outside of their house.
Right.
For 6 months, eight months now. I mean, it's like, I'm going, you're kidding. They go, no. We order everything on Amazon and... you know, because I saw them they go out in their yard. I take that back. Mm-hmm. They've been out their house, but not out of the neighborhood, because I saw them when we were walking the other night. They go, yeah, we haven't been anywhere. I said, yeah, what do you mean? Because I literally didn't know they meant they hadn't been anywhere.
Right.
We go eat like 2-3 times a week at restaurants. I feel pretty safe at a restaurant.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think when people came here for BitBlock Boom, they also were really kind of amazed at how open Texas was, especially they were from like California or New York or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they'd be going, gosh, if it wasn't for seeing a mask once in a while, I wouldn't even know there was any COVID going on. You know, because everything here is back to pretty much normal, except you walk in a store, you got to put a mask on, you know. And then I see the other night that the WHO said that 75% of the people who got COVID said they wore a mask
right
all the time.
Right.
and 15% say they wore it 70% of the time. So, I mean, doesn't sound like that mask is doing much to me,
right?
Except you got to put it on or you can't go in the store.
Yeah.
How
has Texas changed while you've been there? Do you think it's, I mean, I feel like a lot of Californians and maybe, I don't know if New Yorkers are moving there. Is it changed a lot? Is it?
Well, where I'm at, it's not in Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm in a small community right in the middle of Dallas-Fort Worth, but I think Austin has changed a lot. You know, you have a lot of liberals in Austin now where they didn't used to be. So I think that's changed a lot because, yeah, every time you talk to someone and you're somewhere else in the country, if you're in California or New York and you're there talking to someone, I'm from Texas, they go, oh, I'd love to move to Austin. I don't know why they always say that. Mm-hmm. I'd love to move to Austin. Mm-hmm. So there's something there attracting them. I mean, you know, they need to sign some kind of, have to sign some kind of thing when they move here that they won't get involved and vote for them 10 years or something.
Right.
You know, because they do a bad job of it. You know, their history is not good.
Yeah. Yeah,
they have bad track record of who they vote for and what they do when they change rules. That's why they've had to leave. You know, it's kind of like in South Carolina where I grew up at. We had Yankees and we had damn Yankees. Now, I left there when I was like 25,
what's the difference?
26. Well, Yankee is someone, we're just going to say, from New York or New Jersey, somewhere up north, that moves to South Carolina or Charleston, and they just happen to be from up north. That's a Yankee. A damn Yankee was someone who moved, the same person, but you'd say, hey, this thing, yeah, this would be a lot better if we only did this one thing differently, mm-hmm. or if we only had a deep dish pizza, or if we only had this one thing, this would be much, much better. And you're like, well, if it's so much better, why don't you damn go back where you came from?
Right.
You know, that would be a damn Yankee, that everything could be a little bit better, you know, if we just did this. So that was, as a kid, that was our thing. We had Yankees and we had damn Yankees.
Right.
And and that's the way I kind of feel like a lot of people from California are coming in.
Yeah. I'd probably be a damn Yankee. I'm definitely a damn Yankee. Where do you see Bitcoin going? And I'm not talking about price. I'm talking about, you know, just its place in the monetary, you know, ecosystem or acceptance by people or, you know, I'm not sure what your outlook is for the next, really, 10 years. Now, I'm not trying to say like the next year.
Yeah, I don't know if anything's going to happen really in the next 3 to 5 years that's going to be life-changing about Bitcoin, except maybe a store of value, and it's going up. But I foresee that it's just a matter of time before more nations start mining Bitcoin. You know, supposedly Iran's mining Bitcoin, Venezuela's mining Bitcoin. I'm sure there's someone else mining Bitcoin. Once that starts happening and nation states start mining Bitcoin, then other states are going to start mining Bitcoin because they can't let those countries have it all as it starts going up. And once all that happens and it really does start moving at that moment, then the price of Bitcoin is going to cause the changes. Not the change isn't really that it's going up. That's going to happen. But when it gets up to a certain point, then all the changes are going to happen because of the value that Bitcoin has, I think. You know, we'll start seeing more people, more tools being built to use it to buy things, and we'll always have probably the store of value. And then we'll have, I would think, I would think you have a problem in a case possibly with the government wanting your Bitcoin. I mean, they wanted your gold when they didn't have enough. And if it does become in that situation, that could be one of the big things that happened to me, it seems like, is that the government's going to say, you know, we don't have enough Bitcoin, no matter what government it is, and we need yours, just like they needed your gold, you know, in the early 1900s, just like England needed the gold during World War II of their people.
Right.
You know, the first they had them register it, then the next year they took it, you know. So that's what I foresee is going to be the biggest change, is that people are going to try to take it. And they aren't really going to come to your house, I don't think, per se, and take it. I don't think they're going to come to your house and say, hey, we hear you have a treasure in there with 12 Bitcoin on it. We need those. No, what they're going to do is they're going to go to the exchanges and they're going to go, Coinbase, you have $1 billion worth of Bitcoin. We need that. Right. You know, that's it. You don't have an option. And so they'll take it off the exchanges and then they'll do a lot of advertising and convincing people that is the thing to do, that if you don't turn in your Bitcoin, you're a bad person and that you're going to like ruin the government and the country, and the propaganda will come out and people will gladly turn in their Bitcoin too. Some people, just like they gladly turned in their gold,
right?
You know, before they went down there and just gave it to them, said, "Here's my gold.
Yeah,
I need to give it to the country, and you're going to like cut my value, my dollar in half in 6 months. But here's my gold." You right. know? So
do you think
that's
would...
the biggest thing we'll see?
Again, it's not about price in terms of forecasting, but do you think that scenario? I mean, let's Bitcoin's worth more than it is today. And that scenario comes and plays out. Do you think that leads to sort of price suppression, or maybe the reverse, because maybe there's a squeeze? You know, people give up their Bitcoin, and the people that hold it get to reap the rewards. However, that plays out geopolitically.
I just don't see Bitcoin going down or staying stationary for a long time. I mean, you know, I think there'll be cycles where it stays, drops, goes up, stays, drops. You know, all that cyclical stuff with the halvenings. But I would think, like I said, that's just and. Mm-hmm. I'm no master at this. This is just my thoughts from information I've absorbed. If a country doesn't have any Bitcoin, it becomes world currency. They're going to need some.
Right.
I mean, let's just face it. So, and I can't see it staying still in price because it's so limited. They can't make any more of it. There's only 21 million and like close to 19 million are out, you know? So, and 3 million, I think I saw today Fidelity or somebody said that they believe 3 million of it's lost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think anyone knows, but I just don't see any way it could just stay still in price.
Sure.
I mean, you know, when it, especially if there's a world demand like that.
Right. You were the voice of the Railroaded podcast. Is that correct?
Yes. The podcast, yes.
Yeah, that was yes. phenomenal.
No. Let me take that back. I didn't do, Len sent me the Railroaded audio, and I made a podcast out of that audio. I don't want it to be confused. I'm not the person in the background going over the information. I just wanted to get it out there.
So you produced it?
Yeah, she sent me the
got it.
No, the completed audio for every chapter, and then I produced it in the podcast.
Got it.
On episode one, we're going to listen to chapter 1 through 4.
Because your voice. Okay, so you say that part.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm on the beginning and the end.
Got it.
Next week, we'll do episode 5 through 7.
Got it. Because I had listened to that way before I heard of you, and then I was just prepping, and I saw, you know, I saw that in the list, and I've listened to that podcast, and then I just clicked on it quickly, and I heard your voice. I didn't know if you did, I didn't remember if you did the whole thing.
Yeah, no. It was already Railroaded. The audio show was out.
Right.
And I made it into a podcast and kept it. It was on YouTube, I believe, is how they had it as an audio on YouTube.
Got it.
And I turned that audio into a podcast.
Got it. Do you have any more connection to the Ross Ulbricht thing or
we've written a couple letters, that's it. I mean, you know. So Lynn, I like Lynn a lot. I really
yeah.
I felt for Lynn as soon as I just couldn't imagine having my child. You know, so I kind of like, maybe that's just a parental bond, you know,
right.
As soon as I met her, I was like, oh my gosh, I feel so sorry for you.
What did you think of Silk Road as an entrepreneur? I mean, what do you think of that website?
Well, I never saw the website when it was up. I knew of it.
The idea,
I just never
I mean,
went to it.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem to be that complicated of a website. It was a clever idea. It didn't turn out good for him. I don't think it should have turned out as bad as it did. He didn't do anything that wrong. I wasn't there, but it doesn't seem like to me he did anything. And I hear about this him hiring people to like kill people, but I don't think that happened from what I can figure out.
Yeah, I don't think that either from what I.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff that was made up because he was never charged for that.
Yeah.
And I think you at least had the charges on there and you got the worst sentence he could get. I think Ross just really believed that people should be able to do whatever in the hell they want to do with their own bodies. And I think there's a lot of people.
And their own money.
I pretty much believe that way.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone should be telling anyone what they need to do in their bedroom.
Right.
What they need to do. Like, let's take pot, for instance. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. How many people have had lives ruined for marijuana?
Right.
Oh, my gosh. What happens when you smoke a lot of marijuana? You go, hey, can you get them and give me the Cheetos? I can't get them. Yeah, you want to go get some at the grocery store? Nah, I don't want them that bad. What else we got to eat? You don't do anything.
Right.
You know?
Which was the largest product, I think, on the site. And, you know, if you compare it to like Amazon or Craigslist, I mean, nefarious things happen on those sites too via resellers. And management isn't held to the same account as Ross was. And they threw the kingpin charge at him. I thought it was just a really great thesis what he built with the site, that people should be able to connect and do what they want.
Yeah, I agree completely. Like I said, it didn't work out well for him, but that doesn't mean that what his thoughts were not.
Oh, I think it's atrocious what happened to him. And yeah. I think he's been made an example of politically, which is not really constitutional.
Well, I think without a doubt, the judge said she was going to give him the hard, right, she would give him the death penalty if she could.
Right.
For operating an online store.
Yeah, and I learned so much from that podcast, because it's just, chock full of details and all public cited materials from the court case.
They went into that in real depth and really went over the information, I thought, really well, that really gave you information you didn't have. So if you want to listen to it, I mean, you're going to learn something about the case for sure.
Yeah.
And I think at that time they were hoping, they were still hoping to get it to the Supreme Court when that came out.
Yep.
Which that failed. And
yep.
Now they're still going for a presidential pardon.
Right. Yep. It's the only way, I think. And
I think it is too. And he's in there for life, and he's not with good people either.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, some of the people, they've made a broader case out of the Ross case, which is that a lot of people are doing life for, nonviolent crimes. And he's done a bit of a campaign around that, it seems, to kind of bring light to that subject. And that some of the people that are doing life alongside of him are his friends now. And who he spends his time with, obviously, but
right. But he gets moved on, I don't know now, but he was getting moved. Like Glenn would go to see him and he wasn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And they moved him to a whole new prison.
Right. Well, last I heard, he was in Colorado.
That's the last I heard.
Right. And the irony there, he's in a federal prison, but in Colorado, marijuana is completely legal. And the irony.
There are a lot of people in prison for marijuana.
Right. I was going to extend. Right.
It's illegal.
Right. And to extend that to everyone in that situation. I really enjoyed that piece. And I thought that was really important that you guys.
Like I said, and I just immediately felt sorry for Lynn. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't imagine, that happening to me, but she's a real nice person. So I'm sure she seems like the kind of person. It's not like she's my best buddy, but from my, interactions with Lynn, she seems like the kind of person who would raise a kid to be a pretty moral kid.
Yeah. Yeah. His circumstances seem like he was a pretty moral kid. And I think even his idea for the website is incredibly moral. Mm-hmm. Even if you just want to go with the notion that he's been in prison probably for 10 years now, he hasn't touched a computer. What harm could he really do on a computer at this point? If he did, if you want to, he served his time. And I think he served way beyond his time. And I think Bitcoiners should just keep bringing Ross up.
We had a BitBlock boom. I put up every year QR code on the wall, free Ross.
Yeah.
Hoping that we'll get some donations sent to him.
Yeah.
It's what I've done. And like I said, I've tried to get the word out about him, and we've communicated in the mail. And he's got good penmanship.
Yeah. This has been really awesome, Gary. I really appreciate this. I'm excited to come down to the conference next year in 2021. And, if you keep the Dallas barbecues going, I might show up for a Friday. So where can people find you? Because I think people need to hear from you.
Best place to find me is on Twitter, just at Gary Leland. I mean, everything I do, I sooner or later post there. So if you go to at Gary Leland, you're going to see everything I do. I post everything I do, share everything I do. I'm pretty open.
Great.
About me, so it's not like it's a secret. I have been for a long time. My wife goes, I can't believe you're so secretive. You tell everybody you do.
Right.
I go, I don't think I'm that secretive. I tell everybody everything I do.
Well, I encourage you to check out the other pods as well and the things you do.
4-Minute Crypto is a good one. Yep. 4-Minute Bitcoin. I changed the name recently because I do that every day. I try to do that every day, and it's one news article every day in 4 minutes or less.
Yeah, I love it.
So it's a good way to learn Bitcoin because you learn a little bit every day. I mean, without having to learn a ton.
Yeah, there's something to be said for those 4-minute nuggets. Mm-hmm. That you could fit in your day in a different way than maybe a long form pod. So I love it. It's great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Enjoyed coming on. Look forward to meeting you at the BitBlock Boom next year. And hopefully we'll get you down here for some Texas barbecue.
Likewise.
It's going to be some good barbecue.
I love barbecue. So I'm into it. Thank you so much. Peace.
Thank you.
Gary Leland, the Bitcoin boomer, dropping wisdom and sharing his life's experiences with such warmth and generosity right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dug the show, please vote with your thumbs and press those 5 stars. That's the best way to spread the word. This is Cedric. Peace.